And at the same time, we are also taught that if we just become, let's say, ruled by our base instincts, we'll actually sink below the level of the animals. So obviously the high level, the highest levels of humanity that we can attain to actually go beyond, above the angels. And then obviously the very low levels below the animals. So what can we do? Who are these people who achieve these lofty levels of humanity? So for sure, we know that obviously all our infallibles are at the highest levels. The prophets are at the highest levels. Now we know that our martyrs achieve very high levels. But we also have amongst us many people who are purifying themselves, who are very good-hearted and who can also achieve very high levels. So I just want to comment on, for example, one of the martyrs from Holy Defense, Ibrahim Hadi, especially as I've said that this is something that, you know, we can always look to the martyrs to see what did they do? What was so special that made them scale these heights of humanity, basically? So people would say, so friends of Ibrahim Hadi's, for example, would say that they'd never seen anyone like him. But what they also then added, some of his friends said that Ibrahim Hadi had grown up in an area that had produced other people like Ibrahim Hadi. Welcome back to AIDS Ed here on I'm Being Trade with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about these lofty levels of humanity that martyrs can achieve and that everyone else, all of us, can also aspire to achieving. And I've just mentioned that some people commented, for example, on Ibrahim Hadi, one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, and this we'd be able to say similar things about all the other martyrs. So he, for example, had grown up in an area that produced other people like him. People in that area were concerned with halal and haram. People in that area where he grew up as a child, they were concerned about respect and knowledge. Many of these youth also played in the local sports teams there, and many of them got martyred. So who were these people? What was this area? And indeed, what were these times? And as we're talking about times, we're talking about the sort of a time of the Holy Defense. What about now? Can we have this same thing now in our local area? So think about it for yourself. Are people in your area, would you say that people are thinking about halal and haram? Are people aware of this? Is this a really important topic? Being respectful, being knowledgeable, so being able to have conversations about this, being very engaged in the community, contributing, participating, helping the local community, and then to such an extent that, for example, if another war were to happen, is everyone in the same space? Is everyone ready to basically be martyred for Islam, for their country, for the Islamic Revolution, and obviously for Islam, whatever country you're in? So this is something. So, and if we answer to ourselves, well, no, I'm not living in an area like that. Or if you say, no one I know is like that. My friends aren't like that. We don't even talk about things like that. Well, you know, if you're aware of that, you have knowledge, so you be then the person that starts with to start talking about these things. And bit by bit, maybe, you can sort of draw other people into that conversation. And if you're aware that these sorts of things are happening, people are really involved in local community, and you're not yourself, then go out there, sort of go to the majlis, go to the rawza, involve yourself in your community, and keep talking to people. It's really important to sort of also just nurture the community spirit, especially nowadays. So pray that this is just a reminder for all of us. And that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AIDS Ed here on Iron Bush Radio. And farewell for now. thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all the listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Q&A on Islamic beliefs follows next. The program provides answers to listeners' questions about Islamic beliefs. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome, everyone. For years, they lecture the world on the rules-based international order, on property rights, on legal sovereignty, on the sanctity of law. Now, in a move of hypocrisy, the European Union, under the heavy hand of Washington, has simply stolen what is not theirs, $246 billion. Russian sovereign assets seized frozen under a fabricated, quote, emergency. They dress this theft in the language of morality, of supporting Ukraine, but do not be fooled. This is an act of economic warfare, a desperate escalation by a failing bloc tearing up its own legal scriptures to serve a master across the Atlantic. It has shattered European unity with its own members crying rape of law, and it has been promised with a fierce and justified retaliation from Moscow. In this Spotlight episode, we cut through the Western propaganda. We ask who truly ordered this, how deep are the cracks in Brussels, and is this the final foolish blow to any chance of peace? But first, let's get more details in this report.
The European Union has indefinitely frozen Russia's assets in Europe over the Ukraine war. Using a special procedure meant for economic emergencies, the bloc's governments agreed to immobilize $246 billion. Worth of Russian sovereign assets until Moscow ends the war and compensates its neighbor for the damage caused in the conflict. It's a key step that will allow EU leaders to work out at a summit next week how to use the tens of billions of euros in Russian central bank assets to underwrite a huge loan to help Ukraine meet its financial and military needs over the next 2 years. The move has caused rifts within the EU. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban slammed the decision, accusing the European Commission, which prepared the measure, of, quote, systematically raping European law. He said the move means the rule of law in the European Union comes to an end, and Europe's leaders are placing themselves above the rules. Slovakia has also criticized the measure, warning that the use of frozen Russian assets could directly jeopardize efforts to end the Ukraine war. Russia's central bank, meanwhile, said it has filed a lawsuit in Moscow against Euroclear, a Belgian financial group that holds the majority of Russian assets. In a separate statement, The central bank also described wider EU plans to use Russian assets to aid Ukraine as illegal and contrary to international law, arguing that they violated the principles of sovereign immunity of assets. Russian officials have also repeatedly said that tapping the frozen assets would be met with the harshest reaction. The legal battle over frozen funds is taking place as the United States pushes for a ceasefire deal between Moscow and Kyiv. A draft U.S. peace plan released last month envisioned using the frozen funds for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. As a result, their use by European leaders for a loan before a peace deal could cause tension with Washington. But European officials say the alternative is for Ukraine to face a financial crunch. Analysts believe the asset freeze reveals that the bloc is willing to bend its own rules when politically convenient, eroding the very legal order it claims to uphold and exposing deep fractures within the bloc.
Well, in this episode, we are joined by Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joining us from Florida, U.S. And Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. And Mr. Doctorow, let's go ahead and start off with you. Let's start off with this whole legitimacy on the so-called economic emergency procedure, as they're calling it. Now, some people are describing it as a not-so-simple legal loophole, while others are calling it outright theft of a sovereign nation's sovereignty. I mean, what side would you lean to? Obviously, what's in front of us of basically this over these hundreds of billions of euros, of dollars, excuse me, being stolen by the EU?
Well, let's take this in two steps. What happened on Friday was step one. That is that Ursula von der Leyen put before the member states of the European Union a proposal to end the six-monthly renewals of sanctions against Russia, which had within it the freezing of assets. That was done as a first measure to prepare the way for collateralization of a large loan, a loan in the amount of 145 billion euros, to be paid out in two annual portions of 45 billion each, and the remainder to be used to pay off a G7 loan to Ukraine that has fallen due. Now, step one, I say, because if the frozen assets could be ordered released as a result of failure at the six-month intervals to find unanimity and to continue the sanctions, then that would vitiate the basis for having these funds held in collateral. To avoid that, in the anticipation that at least one member state, namely Hungary, would at some point veto the extension by 6 months, they put this to a vote, and von der Leyen won. But I say this is only step one, and it's procedural. It was simply to put in place the holding of those assets, and with the purpose of their being removed from the grips of Mr. Trump, and thereby giving leverage to the European Union in the ongoing negotiations over peace, from which it has been sidelined. So I see the principal importance of what happened yesterday, which was approved, and was even approved by Belgium, which has been the most vocal opponent of the whole notion of collateralization for purposes of a loan to Ukraine. It passed because it was dealing with securing a place at the negotiating table for Europe, period. The big issue, and which is completely uncertain how voting will go and procedurally how von der Leyen will handle it, is still ahead. That's when the European Council, which is the second executive body of the European institutions, whereas the European Commission is the executive carrying out the daily activities of acting as a cabinet. The European Council meets on big issues. It meets once a month, and it consists of the 27 heads of state and heads of government of the European Union.
Yeah, Yes, and Mr. Doctorow, if you don't mind me cutting you off right there, I would like to go ahead and bring in our guest from the U.S., of course, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for your patience. Mr. Johnson, let's talk a bit about, I mean, basically they violate the principle of the sovereign asset immunity. Now, what precedent has the West now actually even put into play? I mean, does what stops any other nation at this moment from seizing any European, any American assets in the future under their own declared, quote, emergencies, or would that even be different in the European or the Americans' own eyes as not acceptable because it's them being attacked here?
Well, this has the potential to set off a whole chain reaction. In fact, we've started to see it with Russia has now filed a lawsuit against Euroclear. I believe it's in a Russian court. But Russia was prepared, for this step. Russia has the potential to seize a variety of European assets. They've avoided doing so because the Russians, in contrast to the Europeans, are much more committed to trying to uphold international law. But all of this, I think, is taking place in the context of we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the international economic order that was established at the end of World War II. Then the United States has been the de facto leader of that for the last 80 years. But now with the rise of BRICS, with the increased cooperation between Russia and China, we're seeing that that whole system starting to unravel because the ability of the West to use economic, financial terms as a bludgeon, as a coercive lever over other states is starting to slip. Recall that it was 10 years ago that Russia and China agreed with the West to impose sanctions on Iran. And now, in the wake of the snapback sanctions, Russia and China both said, nah, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to support Iran. So this is a last desperate play by the Europeans. And frankly, in the whole context of the war in Ukraine, it's not going to make one bit of difference.
And Mr. Doctor, I mean, let's move over a bit to these EU rifts and this hypocrisy being taking place at the moment. Analysts are saying that this reveals that the EU bends its rules when politically convenient. But doesn't this finalize the bloc's transformation from, let's say, a community of law to a mere geopolitical tool for Washington, or has it always been a tool for Washington, in your opinion?
It is a fact. I told you about step one. Step one doesn't violate anything. It simply enshrines in perpetuity what existed till now on a six-month basis. The Russian assets have not been touched. The Russian assets will not be touched when they meet on the 18th and 19th. These are separate issues, but it's very important to make distinctions here to understand why people are voting the way they are. The second step would happen on the 18th and 19th of December, and that is to invoke the same principle of qualified majority, not at unanimity, to vote on the principle of using these assets to open a loan to Ukraine. That already is the point where the assets are touched. Now, as regards the danger of this, it's not just a question of hollow hypocrisy and saying that the European Union doesn't live up to its standards. There's something much more important going on here, and it could lead to the collapse of the global financial system. My colleague has said correctly that the Russians have put a legal action against the holdings that are in Russia and owned by Euroclear. So it's not just the Russians had deposited one way into Euroclear, but Euroclear also keeps deposits with those countries that it deals with. And the Russians are now saying, much more important than the 18 billion euros in Euroclear assets that the Russians can seize at any time they want. More important than that, the Russians are issuing an announcement to the global community to seize Euroclear assets wherever they are. Now, what does this mean and what is Euroclear? Belgium is a small country and people would think normally that Euroclear is small also. Wrong. Euroclear has $43 trillion in assets under its care. If that starts to wind out, if there is an attack on its assets, which put its financial well-being in jeopardy, then the whole system unravels and you have a global financial crisis. So what Mrs. Neal speak about the Europeans, let's be very specific. This is an initiative coming from very few people who are usurpers of power, who are essentially dictators. And the dictator number one is Ursula von der Leyen. She is the one who hatched this idea and is pursuing it with a vengeance. So before we pin the blame on the whole of Europe, you have to look at who is actually the agent of this crime.
Well, as you did point out there, Mr. Doctorow, the situation is definitely more deeper than anyone is expecting. We have to look at the financial part. We have to see the history behind this. Mr. Johnson, I mean, I know we've seen a lot of your analysis on other shows and, of course, everything that you do. I would like to get your opinion on the situation, the significance of the timing specifically about this so-called economic emergency procedure. Is it have any relation to the very fast advancements by the Russian forces there on the ground, in your opinion, or does it have nothing to do with it?
No, it absolutely does. And as Gil correctly noted, I mean, this is an act of utter desperation by the Europeans. It just shows how they don't have any other playbook to go to, because the advance of Russia right now is so comprehensive, so sweeping and so fast that there is literally nothing that the Europeans can do. Even if they, quote, were going to mobilize to send troops to Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainians, it'd be months trying to get their act together on that front. And Gil correctly notes that this poses the potential to unravel the Western-dominated financial system. Because once you destroy faith in an institution's ability to protect your assets, people start going elsewhere. And ultimately, it is the belief that they're going to follow the law, that they're not going to play personal politics. I mean, for goodness sakes, during World War II, my understanding is even though Western banks held financial assets of Nazi Germany that the West was at war with, they still protected those assets. And now here, and just to give you some measure of the desperation, they're willing to throw all of that aside. And again, it would be one thing if they could say, well, if we take that $300 billion, by God, that's going to stop the Russian advance, and it's going to actually force them to retreat. That's not the case.
Well, with that, Mr. Doctorow, I mean, you were talking a moment about who is at fault here. The funds are meant to, quote, as they mentioned, underwrite a loan to Ukraine. Is Europe essentially making the Ukrainian people indebted for decades? I mean, they're coming over money that isn't even theirs to give. How is this going to affect the Ukrainians?
You know, the wording of this loan does not envisage the kind of threat to Ukrainians' interest that you are raising now. It states that the loan falls due at the moment that the Russians pay for the damage they've caused. And the Russians will never pay for the damage they've caused because they're the winners of this war. So this is why it is a transparent confiscation of assets. But the Ukrainians as such will receive the money, will spend the money, will steal the money, and will have no obligation to repay. That is inherent in this deal. Everyone is talking on two sides of their mouth. Mr. De Wever has been extremely brave in risking the wrath of all of the other 26 member countries, 25 member countries, because Hungary certainly would not be angry about what he's doing. But he has gone up against almost all of his colleagues and said in this declaration that was issued yesterday by four countries, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, and Malta. They all said that voting for that waiver of the unanimous voting procedure yesterday, but we can be sure they will not approve application of the same limited majority when it comes up for a vote on applying for a loan against this on the 18th and 19th. Mr. De Wever made firm statements that he supports Ukraine to the end. That's what he says to the European Commission, to look like one of the boys. When he speaks in Belgium, as he did last week, he spoke in French to a gathering in one of the major auditoriums in the center of the city. He said something quite different, that the idea that Ukraine could win this war is a fairy tale and an illusion. He also said to the editor of the major French-speaking newspaper in this town that for Russia to lose this war is not a good idea, considering it's the world's biggest nuclear power, if you follow where the dots lead. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and it's very risky to make facile generalizations about what European leadership thinks. But I think the real issue, when Mr. De Weber and his three colleagues said that they oppose the use of the Russian assets for purposes of a loan, they said, oh, we can do something more constructive. We can give a European loan out of our own pockets for that money. He's saying that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that no European country other than Germany is willing to pony up 2 euros to help Ukraine because they'd have to go to their parliaments. That is the real trick here. This, von der Leyen has done, is to count on the violation of democracy across the whole of the EU, not just in parliament, which she oversees, because it means that money will be put up by European governments without going to their parliaments.
Well, exactly, Mr. Doctorow, as you did mention, I'd like to thank you for clarifying those points in our procedure. As we were mentioning, sometimes we've got to make it very clear to the viewers what is actually meant behind the scenes, behind the ink on the paper, if we may. Mr. Johnson, we have around 4 to 5 more minutes. Let me go ahead and get in a few more questions, if we could. Let's just focus a moment on this Russian response / retaliation. They said that it's going to be harsh. Now, they promised this. What kind of form could we perhaps expect other than what they did to there in Russia? Are we looking at symmetrical seizures of remaining Western assets in Russia, or are we perhaps maybe something asymmetrical, economic, maybe a diplomatic warfare? What are you expecting? What kind of reaction from Russia?
Well, Russia is going to follow. They're going to follow legal procedure. They're not going to act recklessly. They're certainly not going to react emotionally. And we saw the first step of it with the legal action, the filing of the suit against Euroclear that was taken, I believe, yesterday. Going forward, if the Europeans actually move ahead and seize assets, the Russians have made provisions to seize European assets that are still in Russia. And what's interesting is, despite, you know, now 3, going on almost 4 years of war, and several provocations, continued provocations by the West, particularly by Europe, Russia has not gone after those assets because they still put value in the notion of doing things legally, trying to uphold international law, and trying to ensure that there's some sort of order in the system. It's the West that has continually been walking away from agreements and violating the laws. As you said in your opening, it's almost like, you know, it's the golden rule. Those with the gold get to make the rules. And from the United States standpoint, they said, well, we got all the gold, so we're going to make the rules. And that turns out not to be the case. But, you know, I think Russia's well prepared to retaliate, but they're going to do it unemotionally and legally.
Well, Mr. Doctorow, with the last few minutes, I'd like to go ahead and direct my last question towards you. We have to bring up this draft peace plan being brought up by the U.S. Now, they envisioned it using frozen assets for post-war reconstruction, according to them. By jumping the gun, basically, and using them now for this war funding, has Europe just sabotaged Washington's own peace roadmap, or is everything we see planned? Was there even a peace plan at the beginning?
No, you just identified the logic. It's to sabotage the American peace plan.
And with that, I do have just one more question. If you could each answer it in around 30 to 40 seconds, your own words. Ultimately, how will this actually accelerate the global move away from the dollar, the euro-dominated assets, towards alternatives, perhaps among the BRICS nations, around others, who are wary of the Western financial weaponization? For 30 seconds, please, Mr. Johnson, in your own words.
Yeah, well, it's a further reaffirmation that the West is not to be trusted, that the West is a bully, and that they're going to use it whatever economic leverage they have over them. So therefore, the global South, Russia and China, they're moving as quickly as they can to separate themselves from that.
And Mr. Doctorow, your answer, please.
The bottom line is the pitch, the advertiser of a talk show both Larry Johnson and I participate in, My Gold.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. From Florida, USA, Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and of course, as always, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst there, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. A pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaykum. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi from Islamic House of Qom is ready today to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Imam al-Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam, is passing life in major occultation Ghibat al-Kubra. How can the existence of Imam al-Mahdi, a biological body, a person, and his long life be proven according to Islamic traditions and Islamic beliefs, Sheikh Karimi? This is a major question for today. First, let's talk a little bit about existence, and then the long life.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. As we all know, the concept of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is shared by all Muslims, both Shia and Sunni. Both denominations believe in the coming of a person called Mahdi, who will fill the earth with justice. So there is no about that. The only question is whether he is born or not. According to our Sunni brothers, they believe that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will be born in future. And at Shia, we believe that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is the son of Imam Askari alayhi salam, and he was born in the year 255, and now, as you mentioned, passing life in major occultation. Now, especially recently, there are some questions about the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and some have doubted the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, especially some Wahhabis. They even have written books to prove that the Shia cannot prove the existence and the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So first of all, I would like to talk about different narrations, both mentioned by Shia scholars and then some viewpoints of some Sunni scholars about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his very existence. So sometimes some people assume that the narration and the story of the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is just mentioned by Hakima Khatun, and she is the only narrator, and we cannot accept the testimony of a lady. But this is not true.
Okay.
Although, Hakima Khatun is the very lady who was present when Lady Narges was about to give birth to her blessed child, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We have some narrations, for example, حدثتني حكيمة ابنة محمد بن علي. We know that Hakima is the daughter of Imam Jawad alayhi salam, the aunt of Imam Askari alayhi salam. أنها رأته ليلة مولده وبعد ذلك. So Hakima Khatun is only one of the people who witnessed Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, not only on that night, but also later. But there are many other people who have seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam when he was a child. We know that for 5 years, he was passing life in the minor occultation with his holy father, Imam Askari alayhi salam. So many people had this chance to meet Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So to think that it was only Hakima Khatun is a wrong assumption. There are two ladies, Nasim and Maria. They were, servants in the house of Imam Askari alayhi salam. They have mentioned the following, that لما سقط صاحب الزمان عليه السلام من بطن أمه جاثيا على ركبتيه رافعا سببته إلى السماء ثم عطس. So they narrated a story that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, we saw the following, and then they narrated a story and the supplication of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is in Kamaluddin by Sheikh Asadu, page 430. We know that one of the special deputies of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam during his minor occultation is Uthman ibn Sa'id.
Yes.
Al-Amri. Sheikh Qurayni narrates the following narration, that a person told Uthman ibn Sa'id that Anta ra'ayta al-khalafa min ba'da Abi Muhammad alayhi salam. Did you see the successor after Imam Askari alayhi salam? He said, Iwallah, I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I saw him. And then he refers to some of the physical features of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In another narration, we are told about 40 people of the Shia of Imam Askari alayhi salam who were present in his house and Imam Asghar alayhi salam showed them his son, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It's been mentioned that Muhammad ibn Ayyub bin Nuh and Muhammad ibn Uthman Amri, they say, عَرَضَ عَلَيْنَا أَبُو مُحَمَّدْ الْحَسَنُ بْنُ عَلِي وَنَحْنُ فِي مَنْزِلِهِ. We were in the house of Imam Asghar alayhi salam, وَكُنَّا أَرْبَعِينَ رَجُلًا. We were 40 people. And Imam showed us his son and said, هَذَا إِمَامَكُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِي. This is your Imam after me, وَخَلِفَتُكُمْ عَلَيْكُمْ أَتِيعُوهُ. You need to obey him.
Ahmad ibn Ishaq al-Qumi is another one
who
had the chance of meeting him. He was the special deputy of Imam al-Jawad, Imam Hassan al-Askari, Imam al-Hadi, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So when Imam al-Zaman, Imam al-Mahdi was 3 years old, he asked Imam Hassan al-Askari about the Hujjah on earth.
Exactly.
What do you mean by Hujjah? Imam gets in, brings out a three-year-old child, Imam al-Mahdi, and showed him to him, this is the Hujjah of Allah, okay?
Abu Ghanem is another servant in the house of Imam Asghar alayhi salam. He says that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was only 3 days old, Imam Asghar alayhi salam showed him to some of his companions. He said, وَلَدَ لَأَبِي مُحَمَّدْ وَلَدٌ فَسَمَّاهُ مُحَمَّدًا. A child was born for Imam Asghar alayhi salam. He called him, he named him Muhammad. فَعَرَضَهُ عَلَىٰ أَصْحَابِهِ يَوْمَ الثَّالِثِ. On the third day after his birth, the Imam showed him to his companions, saying, هَذَا صَاحِبُكُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِي وَخَلِفَتِهِ عَلَيْكُمْ. This is the Imam, your Imam after me, وَهُوَ الْقَائِمُ. And this is the Qa'im that people are waiting for. And so these are some of the people who have seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It's not only limited to Hakima Khatun.
Yes.
As I mentioned, only one narration refers to 40 people. And then in some narrations, we are told that Imam Askari alayhi salam has told some of his companions that Mahdi has been born. For example, in one narration, Abu Hashim Ja'fari says that I asked Imam Askari alayhi salam that, Ya Sayyidi, hal laka walad? Oh, my master, do you have a child? فَقَالَ نَعَمْ. The Imam said, yes. I asked, فَإِنْ حَدَثَ بِكَ حَدَثٌ فَأَيْنَ أَسْعَلُهَمْ. If something happens to you, meaning that if you pass away, where should I look for him? قال بالمدينة, in the city of Medina. So in this narration and similar narration, some people may have not seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but they received the news of his birth from Imam Askari alayhi salam. So these are some narrations referring in Shia corpus, referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, and so many people either saw and met him or heard the news of his birth from Imam Askari alayhi salam.
So, from one side, we want to prove the existence of Imam al-Mahdi, the last Shia Imam and the Savior, okay? So this is Mahdi al-Ghaib. But from the other side, some people might say that, is it possible, for example, for Imam al-Hasan al-Askari not to have children? I mean, and this was the only son to Imam Hasan al-Askari, isn't it?
Yes.
So being only one child, I think might answer itself lots of questions, that why only one child, okay? So one child to Imam Hassan al-Askari, and also being the last proof of Allah on earth. So, because if there were several children, on that time there might be so many questions that why, for example, the other Imams or the other sons will not be the last proof of Allah on earth. So being limited only to one child, I think it is itself a good answer.
Yeah, very good
of point. We can't say being the last point.
And that is why we have Ja'far al-Kadhab, because Imam Askari al-Sarab didn't have any other
sons.
Ja'far al-Kadhab was another person who claimed to be the next Imam, and then he was rejected by Imam Mahdi al-Sarab. So these are some narrations in Shia sources. As I mentioned, according to Sunni sources, we can also prove the birth of Imam Mahdi al-Sarab. Of course, they do not believe that this is Imam Mahdi al-Sarab, but the point is that many Sunni scholars, they have mentioned in their books that Askari, Hassan Askari, who is the 11th Shia Imam, he had a child whose name was Mahdi.
Mahdi, that's
so this in and of itself proves that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born. Although they do not believe in Imam Askari alayhi salam to be the 11th Imam, they do not believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to be the promised Mahdi.
But historical fact that he had one
exactly.
Son.
That's I mean historical testimonies of these scholars. For example, Abu al-Fida, who passed away in 732, a scholar of the 8th century after Hijra, he says the following, that he talks about Imam Askari alayhi salam, and then he says, وَهُوَ وَالِدْ مُحَمَّدْ al-Muntazar. He is the father of Muhammad al-Muntazar, and Muhammad al-Muntazar هو ثاني عشر الأئمة الاثني عشر على رأي الإمامية. So first of all, he proves that Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam had a child whose name was Muhammad, and of course he says that this Muhammad is the 12th Imam, according to the Shia, who is called Al-Qa'im, Al-Mahdi, Al-Hujjah. So in and of itself, Abu al-Bada, historically speaking, proved that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born. Ibn al-Wardi, who passed away in 749, another Sunni scholar, he says that Wal-Hasan al-Askari walidu Muhammad al-Muntazar, the same statement, he also proved that Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child whose name was Muhammad. His title was Muntazar. He is the 12th Imam of the Shia. وَيُلَقَّبْ أَيْضًا الْقَائِمُ وَالْمَهْدِي وَالْحُجَّةِ. The Shia calls him with different titles, like Qa'im, Mahdi, and Hujjah. Ibn Hajar, the famous Sunni scholar who passed away in 973, in his famous book, As-Sawa'iq al-Muhriqa, in which in many cases he criticizes the Shia, he also proves that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, and Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child. He says, وَلَمْ يُخَلِّفْ غَيْرَ وَلَدِهِ أَبَ الْقَاسِمْ مُحَمَّدْ الْحُجَّةِ. Imam Askari, of course, he does not call him Imam Askari alayhi salam. Yes. Hassan al-Askari did not leave any children except for Abu al-Qasim Muhammad, and وَعُمْرُهُ عِنْدَ وَفَاتَ أَبِيهِ خَمْسُ سَنِينَ. When his father, Imam Askari, passed away, he was only 5 years old. We know that Imam Askari salam passed and was martyred in 260, and Imam Mahdi was born in 255, so he was only 5 years. And Manawi, who passed away in 1031, another Sunni scholar, he quotes from Bastami that talks about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, even his mother, وَأَمَّا أُمُّهُ فَإِسْمُهَا نَرْجِسِ. He even refers to the name of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, which is Narjis. So these are some historical testimonies by Sunni scholars. As I mentioned, unfortunately, nowadays even we see among some Shia who may doubt the historicality of the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. As I mentioned, not only in the Shia sources, but according to Sunni scholars of Hadith and history, for sure, Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child. He was born in 255, and no one can doubt about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Shaykh, you said that some of our Sunni brethren believe that Imam Mahdi will be born later, isn't it?
Yeah.
So is it clear from who is the father and mother?
The name of the father of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, according to some, to Sunni scholars, they refer to, there are two viewpoints here. Some of them, they believe that he is from the generation of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and some believe that he is from the generation of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this is what is mentioned in Sunni narrations, is that for sure he is one of the offsprings of Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha. This is for sure. But whether he is from the offspring of Imam Hassan or Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there are conflicting narrations in Sunni sources.
So the parents are alive. You mean generation after generation?
Yeah, and
the later generation?
Yeah.
Thank you, Imam Sheikh, for proving the existence of Imam al-Mahdi as the son of Imam al-Hasan al-Askari. You know, it was very kind of you. So historically speaking, according to historical facts, Imam Hassan al-Askari is the father, Najas Khatun, who is believed to be from the Roman lineage, isn't it?
According to one narration,
is the mother. And he is passing life in major occultation. There are still so many questions for the long life of the Imam. Let's shift it to the other discussion, inshallah. Thank you much for this episode. Thank you much, dear listeners. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. Also send us your questions and emails to englishradio@sinarabi.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. علي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all listeners of Iran Radio. Greetings to you wherever you are in the world. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour here in Tehran. We'll start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature that will be followed by Leader's Speech. The program presents a selection of statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution. That will be followed by radio productions feature. After that, we have For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are addressed in this program. Stay with us for the next hour.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. 19-year-old Zahra Abdulkarim Mohanna had a single priority during the two-year genocide raging on them in Gaza. That is to protect her brothers and save their lives at any cost. Having lost her father, she preferred pangs of hunger than risk her brothers going to seek aid where scores of young men were targeted, disappeared, and shot. They have resisted the occupation and always will, Zahra says, but asks why they need to do that when the rest of the world is free. Here is more of Zahra.
Despite the history, occupation, and Gaza's classification as the world's largest open-air prison by many who experienced its suffocating conditions, there was a semblance of a life. For young Palestinians like the one who shared her story with us, there was a rhythm to life, with the Israeli occupation simply the soundtrack. Building a future despite Gaza's situation was something that kept the next generation hopeful, studying, preparing, and working towards a day when there would be a different world. Israel's barbarity has replaced that with something utterly different. Life under genocide was a literal hellscape. The struggle to find something to eat outweighed by the psychological torture, in Zahra's case, of wondering if the occupation would martyr or take her brothers at any given moment. Activities once considered routine now took on an additional layer of jeopardy. Some of the sights witnessed are enough to change your very DNA, such as the tragedy playing out in real time. It's not just the obvious lack of regard for Palestinian lives. It's also the way in which Israel's genocide has changed even the landscape of Gaza. Orphans have been created, children forever scarred in an environment that is now completely alien, with all familiarity wiped from the face of the earth. Coming to terms with the new reality of Gaza has altered some things. There is no way the people, the ones who survived in any case, would not emerge unscathed. Though the one thing that has remained is the Palestinian steadfastness. It was terrifying how quickly Zahra's life, like the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, became centered on the search to satiate hungry bellies. With such scarcity, finding sustenance would consume Gazan lives. Every day, Zahra checks in on the condition of her immediate family, a literal headcount, and then begins the soul-sapping business of making it through another day. The genocide has left those who have survived it physically absolutely spent. The new truce, or the so-called ceasefire, cannot be another false dawn. Something more just and lasting is needed. Palestinians are beyond tired.
Joining me today to discuss Zahra's story is Fatima Dosa, who is a pharmacist and a political activist. Welcome, Fatima.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Fatima, you've spent decades, you know, advocating for the rights of Palestinians. I know you've been doing so many different kind of things, you know, over the years. We have watched Palestinian women, you know, generation after generation, suffering what Zahra is talking about. She's 19 years old. But this is not something that, you know, she's born into it. Her mother was born into it. Her grandmother's gone through it. Fatima, will this ever end?
It's a very important question, Sakina. You know, you're right in saying that throughout our lifetime, you know, in my 40th decade, and that's all we've seen, it's the same conversations and it's the same stories. And the endurance of Palestinian women and what they've suffered is because of the dispossession, the displacements, the occupation, the apartheid. And it can only end when justice is done, when they're no longer living in fear. You know, they're fighting for their, what we're seeing in this genocide is they're fighting for their very existence. But I have every hope that this will end when Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. You know, as we are seeing, as the decades have gone by, their story has come more and more in the front. And we are seeing that the world has now woken up to the reality of what Palestine is, the dispossession, the occupation, and that Israel is now very much a pariah state. You know, the narrative has changed totally. And I have every hope that what we see in the liberation of Palestine, that it will not only be a dream that is whispered in the night, but it will be a lived reality for the Palestinians and for the women and the children that have gone through so much decade after decade.
Do you think it is this genocide that has created this momentum?
I've
said before, we've done processions for many, many, many years. But it would be, you know, when something happens, people go onto the street and then everybody forgets about it. You know, when we talk of the BDS, we boycott things for a while and then we go back into it. But do you think that has changed? Do you think the momentum in watching a live stream genocide has changed things?
You know, you're right. Again, this is the first time that we are seeing a live stream genocide and that the social media has captured this. You know, sometimes we blame social media for a lot of bad things, but actually it is social media that has opened a lot of people's eyes to the reality, because what they have seen cannot be unseen. You know, one thing that really, a phrase that caught me once when I was listening to Butch Weir, who was had stood up for the vice president of the Green Party in America, was that we have to move from being a moment, what happened with George Floyd was a moment, but to make it into a movement. And now what we see is a movement. You know, the outrage that we have seen is organized. That even when the ceasefire was called, the march that happened was the biggest after the ceasefire was called. People could see through that ceasefire and the superficiality of that ceasefire. And that people out on the streets, throughout the globe, in every strata of society, are committed to having that free Palestine and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, and to make sure that their future now is not decided by the imperialists and the colonizers, but by the Palestinians themselves, including the people who have sought to have armed resistance.